Well, as you can see on the screen there, Brother Peter is going to talk tonight about the history of the Jews in Western Europe. To introduce his remarks, he's asked us to read a short passage from Deuteronomy chapter 28. Deuteronomy chapter 28. You'll see it's a long chapter, so we're going to start at verse 58. So with that short introduction, we'll ask Brother Peter to talk to us tonight about the history of the Jews in Western Europe.
Well, good evening, dear brethren and sisters. We have an immense task this evening. We've got to cover 2,000 years in 40 or so minutes, 2 minutes a century. So obviously we've got to be very selective. So we'd rather give a flavour of the history of the Jews in Europe rather than a lot of detail. But even so, what we say may well turn out to be a little bit of a catalogue, but I'm sure that you will understand that. We'll find that our study is an exact fulfillment of the words of Deuteronomy that we have just read. Israel were promised dispersion, periods of apparent security and prosperity that were suddenly dashed by disaster, outbreaks of hatred, persecution and death. And in all this, as we'll see throughout our study this evening, we have God's hand at work. So let's start right at the beginning with Roman times. The Jews' troubles started with the Jewish revolt that led to the desolation of Jerusalem in AD 70. And that was followed by further strictures on Jerusalem. So by the mid-second century AD, Jews were banned from Jerusalem, and there were comparatively few left in the whole of Palestine. But in those days, there were about 7 million Jews in the Roman Empire. Most of these were in what the Jews termed the diaspora, a Greek word that means scattering. They weren't evenly spread throughout the Roman Empire and Europe. As you see, there were pockets in Egypt, Asia Minor, North Africa, Italy, Gaul, that is France, and Spain. Now, during the first 3 centuries of this era, both Jews and the emerging Christian church were subject to persecution by the Roman state. But once Christianity had become the state religion in the days of Constantine, the Jews became the sole objects of attack by the authorities. And part of the policy of the developing Christian rulers was to suppress all religious opposition in order that the new system of apostate Christianity, as we know it is, could flourish. Thus, despite the strong Jewish roots of Christianity, the Jews were singled out with particular hostility. For example, soon after Christianity became the state religion, anti-Jewish feelings were made official. A council was held in Elvira in Spain. You can see it there in the bottom eastern part of Spain. And in this council, they forbade Catholics to let their daughters marry Jews. Catholic girls may not marry Jews or heretics, because they cannot find a unity when the faithful and the unfaithful are joined. Parents who allow this to happen shall not commune for 5 years. So social contacts with Jews were also banned at this time. And such decrees as this led the Jews to migrate north into Europe. Now, the next two centuries, the 5th and the 6th AD, saw the gradual collapse of the Roman Empire, and as we know from our studies of Revelation, the papacy inherited the power of the previous Roman emperor. It was during this period that the notion that the Jews had been responsible for the death of Christ, it gained official support. It wasn't at that time reflected in any overt persecution, but the underlying feeling was there for the next millennium or so. But when we've come forward to the time of Charlemagne, AD 800, who set up the Holy Roman Empire, the Jews were very favourably treated. They prospered greatly under official protection. So modern Germany, as you see, was part of this Frankish Empire, and a specific branch of Jewry developed there from the 8th century onward. And due to the specific protection given by Charlemagne and his successors, the Jews developed their trading and their well-known financial expertise. In fact, in the language of the times, the word Jew actually meant merchant. And that part of Europe, the area around Germany, was for some reason named after the biblical character Ashkenaz. So the Jews called themselves Ashkenazim, a description that now applies to all Jews of Central European origin. The other main of Jewry, the Sephardim, developed a separate culture in Spain in the Mediterranean region, and we'll look at that in a few moments. Just before the time of Charlemagne, was the advent of the Islamic movement. It was commenced by Mohammed down in Arabia, and the religion spread rapidly across North Africa and thence into southern Spain. The Muslims brought a new civilization to the Mediterranean area, and their culture and achievements were far in excess of the stagnant Europeans. They excelled in architecture, science, medicine, music, and the arts. Any who have visited Granada or Cordoba can appreciate the heights of Islamic achievements and architecture. The Muslims, like the Jews, but unlike the then Christians, believed in one God, and so they were very ready to tolerate the Jewish religion, provided they accepted the concept of Islamic superiority. This applied throughout the Muslim world. Even in Jerusalem, the Jews were tolerated and supported. That is, until the advent of the Crusades, more of which later. So looking at this map then, we see that the pink area describes the limit of the Muslim conquests, and the yellow patches in that map indicate the areas of major Jewish settlements. And you can see that the Jews at that time were treated fairly well. But, as we will see, it was in Spain that the Jews flourished. Indeed, the years 900 to 1200 are termed the golden years of Spanish Jewry. You can see there's a major settlement in the southern portion of Spain. By the time of the Islamic conquest, the southern part of Spain was conquered by them, and the Jews there formed 6 to 10% of the population. And for nearly 20 years, the caliphs in Granada supported the Jews. They achieved prosperity, and many obtained high office at the Moorish court. So it may seem so far that the prophecies in Deuteronomy were being dangers of being falsified. However, we know that the mills of God grind slowly. And soon there came ominous signs that heralded intense troubles for the Jews that were to come. Now, we in this country remember the year 1066 as the date of the Norman invasion of England. But the Jews of Spain remembered it as the first sign of impending trouble. Joseph Nahargud, the Jewish vizier, prime minister of Granada, and here is not the picture of him, but his father, Samuel Haganagid, who was a very famous scholar, but his son Joseph, the vizier, was accused by some Muslims of favouring the Jews. As a result, he was murdered in a palace intrigue. And then the Muslims of Granada stormed the Jewish quarters of a city. It was a terrible occasion. 4,000 Jews were killed. And that was the first, but by no means the last, persecution of the Jews in Spain. Our attention must now be directed toward northern Europe, the Ashkenazim. In the 10th and 11th centuries, the Jews in France and Germany lived at peace with their neighbours. There were about 20,000 Jews in Germany, and they were present in all the major German cities. They were prosperous merchants. Many were fine scholars, especially of the Jewish Talmud. But then persecution commenced. This persecution had many causes, mainly stemming from the intolerance of the Christian clergy. And this persecution came to prominence around the year 1000, when the Christians had millennial celebrations. And in those millennial celebrations in the year 1000 or so, they focused on the Jewish involvement in the crucifixion, which, as we said, was an inherent view of the Catholics right from the 3rd century onwards. And this focused on the Jewish involvement of the crucifixion and what at first was a simmering anti-Jewish feeling was crystallised by the burning in Jerusalem of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in around 1009. Seems strange that this event should have such far-reaching effect, but a rumour spread throughout Europe that this burning of the Holy Sepulchre, one of the holiest places of Christendom, was done by the Caliph on the advice of some Jews from Orléans in France. This resulted in the expulsion of Jews from the cities of Orléans, Limoges, and Mans. So the plight of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem and the presence of the so-called infidel in Jerusalem, that is, the Muslims, prompted a series of crusades by the Europeans in an attempt to drive the Muslims from the Holy Land. And all this was orchestrated by the Catholic Church and the Pope. Here is Pope Urban II, seated on the left on his throne, preaching about the first crusade, and this meeting took place at Clermont in 1095. Well, when the Crusades got underway, anti-Jewish settlement erupted into violence. As they gathered, for example, at Rouen in the spring of 1096, one said, "We desire to go and fight God's enemies in the East," that's the Crusades, "but we have before our eyes certain Jews, a race more inimical to God than any other." And so they dragged the Jews into the church, and those that refused baptism were murdered. One report says that almost all the Jews in Gaul, that is France, perished. The Jews in France then sent warnings to their fellow Jews in Germany. But they, confident in the patronage and protection of the nobility, ignored the advice to flee from Germany. But the persecution spread there. Soon, 800 Jews died at Worms, many more in Mainz. In all, 500 of the 20,000 Jews in Germany perished during this persecution arising from the First Crusade. And even English Jews were not exempt. And some Jews had come to England with the Norman conquest. During the Third Crusade, 1198, an attack on Jewish quarters in London extended to York. And the terrified Jews in York fled to the castle of York for protection. They were admitted, but due to the treachery of the nobles, they were then besieged by the town folk in Clifford's Tower, that tower which still stands right in the centre of York today. After defending bravely to no avail and seeing siege engines being brought into the attack, they all committed suicide on the advice of their rabbi. And that is commemorated in a plaque at the bottom of the mound on which Clifford's Tower stands. On the night of Friday, March the 16th, 1190, some 150 Jews and Jewesses of York, having sought protection in the royal castle on this site from a mob incited by Richard Malbise and others, chose to die at each other's hands rather than renounce their faith. Back to France in 1182, Philip ordered the imprisonment of all Jews in his realm and then their expulsion. This was rescinded 16 years later, but only after the crown had seized all Jewish lands, and so the poor Jews, having had their territory taken away, had to go where they could. And this picture from the Times depicts the Jews with their wagons and their goods and chattels moving on to the next town that would have them. During the Second Crusade, as Europe was preparing for this second attack to try and deliver Jerusalem, a rumour went around that the Jews had murdered Christian children in order to use their blood in the preparation of Passover bread. It's known to history as the blood libel. It's completely untrue, but truth is never an impediment in such cases. The result was a widespread persecution of the Jews and an increasing feeling of antagonism between the two faiths. But that deprivation of the Jews of their lands and property had, in some ways, a beneficial effect. The Jews had to look elsewhere for their income. And also, at this time, there was a great money shortage in Europe. Population was increasing, agriculture was booming, commerce was increasing greatly at this time. Also, there's an import of Oriental luxury goods, not to speak of the costs of the Crusades, and all needed to be financed from meagre sources. The church was wealthy, but they had an objection to loaning money on interest. They called it usury. And some of the ventures of the day were quite risky, and a return on the capital was essential. But the Jews were permitted by the law of Moses to loan on interest, provided it was to non-Jews. And because of the uncertainty of the times, many of them had converted their assets into gold. Here was a ready store to finance, at a price, the necessities and the whims of the nobility. A good example is in England of Aaron of Lincoln. He was one of about 4,000 Jews in England at that time, and he was a moneylender to the nobility and even the kings of both England and Scotland. His was the finance that made possible the building of 8 monasteries, the Abbey of St. Albans, the cathedrals of Lincoln and Peterborough. You can see then what a good source of income these Jews were for, or at least for money lending. But even so, the Jews felt very insecure, and they built stone houses for their protection. And here is a well-known example of the Jews' house in Lincoln, dating back to medieval times. See how strong it was, and the Jews would have necessarily barricaded themselves in there to protect them and their treasures. We may recall from our schoolboy days that, sorry, I should have said schoolgirl days as well, shouldn't I? From our history days at school anyway, that Richard III was captured on his way back from one of the Crusades and imprisoned in a castle in France. He was there for a long time, but it was mainly the Jews of England who raised the ransom that set him free. But because the Jews were very rigorous in exacting their debts and the interest on them, they incurred the hatred of the ruling classes of England, especially the barons. And it's interesting that 2 clauses of the Magna Carta were specifically put in to limit the claims of Jews on the estates of those who had died whilst in debt to these Jews. So thus, the Jews' weapon was really turned on themselves, resulting from the expulsion of the Jews from England in 1290. They fled to Flanders, Germany, and France. In the latter place, they were immediately refused permission to settle, and the existing Jews were imprisoned, their land confiscated, and then they were expelled. So the pressures toward religious and social segregation between Jews and Christians increased as a result of the Fourth Lateran Council of 1215, which says, "We decree that such Jews and Saracens of both sexes in every Christian province and at all times shall be marked off in the eyes of the public from other peoples through the character of their dress." And the most common application of this was what became known as the Jewish badge. There are various designs. Here are some 2 travellers on horses, you can see, with the Jewish badge, that little round circle with a star in the middle, which would immediately point them out as Jews. Here is another example. In Germany, a 15th century law made all Jews wear this distinctive hat. At Worm in Germany, here is a picture of a merchant there. You can see he's got the distinctive hat, and on his cloak he's got the Jewish badge. Obviously quite a wealthy man, but it was always obvious who he was and what was his race. Or there's another example of Jobst Mellern of Prague, again with the hat and the badge. Coming on to the 14th century, there was more political and economic instability. This was accentuated by the Black Death, which ravaged Europe. Today we know that the Black Death was caused by an organism transmitted by the bite of a flea who had previously fed on rats, which then died. Remember the reference in Samuel to the rats that mar the land after the bubonic plague that affected them there. But needless to say, the pandemic of the Black Death was blamed on the Jews. It was alleged that they had poisoned all the wells, and so the drinking water was the cause of the contagion. The fact that the Jews suffered equally with the rest did not prevent massive persecution over all the European and Mediterranean region. And here's a, I don't know where it came from, but it's a picture from those times depicting the treatment of the Jews because of their alleged involvement in spreading the Black Death. As you can see, they are being burnt alive. This persecution went throughout all the Mediterranean regions as well. But the violence against the Jews stemming from the Black Death spread into Spain in the end of the 1300s. In Seville, then Toledo, then Cordoba, thousands of Jews perished in what was termed a holy war. Their books were publicly burned. And here's a picture by a contemporary artist of the Jews' books being so destroyed. Many Jews abandoned their faith, at least outwardly, and were baptized in order to escape persecution. They were called converses, but the faithful Jews called them maranos, or swine. It came to a climax in 1492 with the appointment in Spain of the Grand Inquisitor. 30,000 Jews were put to death because they would not become Christian. And here again is the same artist actually depicting the scene of the Inquisition with the Inquisitor up on his seat and the poor victims down below, naked and about to be murdered. Now, in the 15th century, Spain was still divided into the Christian north of Spain and the Islamic south. But this breach was healed in 1492 when the Moors were driven from Spain back across the to the Mediterranean coast. Only the Jews now stood between a united Spanish kingdom. And here is a painting that depicts the King of Castile's advisers asking him to expel all Jews. This was first done in 1492 when 100,000 Jews left Spain, first for Portugal, where they were allowed to stay if they could pay a certain price. If not, they had to go somewhere else. They went to the Ottoman Empire, to Italy and Poland. Now in the Ottoman Empire, which was obviously Islamic, the Jews again prospered. After the fall of Constantinople to the Saracens in 1492, Jews became prominent and very prosperous. In fact, one of them, Moses Harman, you can see he's dressed here in very ornate dress, became physician to Suleiman the Magnificent, the ruler of the whole of the Turkish Empire. He was the most powerful ruler of his time. And if, I think I'm right in saying that if you see pictures of the old wall of Jerusalem as it is today, then that was built by Suleiman the Magnificent. Also in Italy, the Jews were prominent in Rome and in Venice, where they provided a major part of the wealth and fostered the arts that went on at the time. This was the time now of the Renaissance. We know the wonderful works of art which went on in Italy at that time. But it wasn't to last. In 1555, Pope Paul IV published a decree that all Jews must live in one quarter. They couldn't live anywhere where they liked in a town or city. They had all to live in one quarter. They weren't to go out at night, and they were banned from all the lowest occupations. And they were forced to wear the yellow hat that indicated that they were Jews. Well, in Venice is one of the islands that, of the many that make up the city, and that became a Jewish quarter. That is where the Jews went as part of this edict. Now, prior to the Jews going there, there had been an iron foundry on that island. And the Italian for that is Ghito Vecchio. So here was the first Ghito or ghetto. And here's an example of the Jewish ghetto on that island in Venice. And the idea soon spread. And within a few years, almost every major city in Europe had its ghetto. It was oppressive for the Jews, but at least it had the effect of preserving Jewish identity and their culture. On this slide, I know you can't read the names of the towns, but you can see that each one of those little black dots was a town that had a Jewish ghetto in the years onwards from the time that we're talking about. Do you notice also towards the top right, there's a little grey area that's called the Pale of Settlement. That was an area beyond which Jews were not allowed to travel any further into Russia. So they were restricted from going into Russia. They couldn't go beyond the Pale of Settlement, hence our term beyond the pale, which we often use today to describe someone who is ostracized. So we come on to the Reformation. That was an upsurge, as we know, of religious reform directed against the Roman Catholic Church. And if the Jews of Germany hoped that the Reformation would relieve them from some of those persecutions that Rome had imposed on them, then they were very disappointed. Because Martin Luther, the so-called father of the Reformation, was surprisingly very anti-Jewish. In fact, in 1542, he published a book on the Jews called On the Jews and Their Lies. It's still available today in print, and this is actually a photocopy of a paperback cover of it. But he was very vehement against the Jews. He describes them as a damned, rejected race. And in the book, he says they are an incorrigible whore and an evil slut, the multitude of the whoring and murderous people, the devil incarnate, let themselves be slaughtered like wretched cattle, and most damnably, we are not at fault in slaying them. So you can imagine how the Jews felt there. But fortunately, although Catholicism was still fairly powerful and the rulers powerful in Germany, the Netherlands became Protestant. Now, at that time, the Spanish throne had inherited the Protestant Netherlands. And promptly, the Netherlands people revolted against the new Spanish rule. And England supported the Netherlands in this battle against Spain, and that was the result of the Spanish War and the Armada in Elizabeth's time. But the result that the Jews had a tradition of tolerance of Jews. And this continued from about Elizabeth's time right down to the Nazi era. The Jews were absorbed into the cities of the Netherlands. Here, for example, is a synagogue which still stands today in Amsterdam, which was built in 1675. He has an interior view, saying what a well-appointed place it was. Beautiful building. And the worshippers there, the Jews, were obviously very relaxed and quite happy. Here's another view of another synagogue at Krakow in Poland, or yet another one in Prague. So despite the fact that, according to Luther, the rabbis should be forbidden to preach, their synagogues should be burnt, all travelling privileges were then removed, in the Netherlands, the Jews were given great freedom. And it's from the Netherlands that the Jews returned to England. They had been expelled from it in 1290, but under the Commonwealth, they returned safely to England. And so we come on to more modern times. By and large, in the 17th to 19th century, European Jews had a time of peace and prosperity. They were apparently secure, with all the persecution behind them. There were isolated examples of anti-Semitism in France, Poland, the Ukraine, and even in the USA, but nothing to indicate that the old hatred of the Jews was only just still below the surface. And certainly, there was no hint of that in Germany. The European population of Jews had grown to many millions, and Jews became accepted in all walks of life, including national politics. Their synagogues were respected and protected. Here are German Jews outside their synagogue on one of their Sabbath meetings. But Napoleon was especially friendly to the Jews. In this slide, and it's the best I could do, I know it's a little bit out of focus, but I'm sure you can get the picture. Napoleon is extending his hand to the Jewish nation, here portrayed as a Jewess. Her hand is resting on the Ten Commandments, and behind her is the menorah, the symbol of the Jewish nation. And so the Jews felt quite secure during these times. Now, in the mid-19th century, the idea of the Jews returning to Palestine was mooted, at first with little support. But in the providence of God, something happened to make the idea more attractive to the Jews. And this is what is known as the Dreyfus trial in Paris. Despite Napoleon's pro-Jewishness, some in France did not share the same view. And towards the end of the 19th century, there was a Jewish but French soldier, a Captain Dreyfus, marked here with his hand in the foreground on his sword. He was accused of spying. When it came to trial, it was obvious that the underlying reason for the charge was that he was a Jew. He was demoted from the ranks. He was forced to give up his sword, and here's a picture of him being defrocked, as it were, and his sword broken. It became known as the Dreyfus Affair, but on appeal this was all refused. But it did show that the underlying sentiment against the Jews was still quite strong. But to report this trial was an Austrian Jew, Theodor Herzl. and being reporting at this trial impressed on him the strength of anti-Jewish feeling and the growing conviction that the Jews would only be safe in their own land. Thus, the Zionist movement was born with the results that we all recognise today. This achieved official recognition in 1917 with the Balfour Declaration issued by the British Foreign Minister Henry Balfour, when you see him there. That is, in fact, a copy of the original Balfour Declaration. You won't be able to read it, but we'll repeat the important phrase is, His Majesty's government view with favour the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavours to facilitate the achievement of this object. Although many Jews in impoverished countries returned to Palestine under this Balfour Declaration, many others, especially in Germany, felt so secure that they did not feel any impetus to migrate. But how mistaken they were. With the rise to power of Hitler in the early 1930s, his concept of a master race which must not be corrupted or diluted by those of lower origins, especially Jews, and he then commenced a specific campaign to destroy all Jews within his sovereignty. This campaign progressed in three stages. The first, from 1933 to 39. This was to impoverish and humiliate the Jews without their actual physical extermination. In 1935, all Jews were expelled from universities. And then, the same year, the Nuremberg Laws pronounced all Jews unclean and unfit for any social contact with Germans. Jewish literature was publicly burned. Yet again, you see, this has happened. He enforced a boycott of Jewish shops. And here is a Jewish shop in 1938. As you can see, the shutters have been drawn across and the German soldiers are in front telling people not to go there. Germans, defend yourselves, the placard says. Well, this resulted in mass emigration of Jews. Within a year, 70,000 had come to England and the USA, and sadly, 8,000 had committed suicide. Well, then in March 1938, Germany annexed Austria. We're now getting into the start of the World War II, and applied the same anti-Semitic legislation to that country. So now 500,000 Jews were under German rule in Austria. And in one terrible night in November 1938, the Nazis looted, smashed, burnt Jewish shops and temples. They went around smashing the shop fronts of every Jewish shop. Hence that was known as Kristallnacht, the broken glass night. And here are some pictures of that time. They also went into all the Jewish synagogues. And here is one of those ornate synagogues, now absolutely ruined. In France, the old practice of making a Jew wear labels were reinstated. And we see we have an example of the badge that says Jew. With the commencement of the war, Hitler's program entered its second phase, with all Jews in Europe under Nazi domination, he became more brutal. But the Jews were considered the real enemy of Germany. Here is a poster which depicts how the Jews viewed the Allies, saying that the Jews were merely the pawns in a Jewish game. That slogan reads, "Behind the enemy powers, the Jews." See that caricature of the Jew there and the three flags of Russia, America, and the USA. Well, we pass over the rest quickly without illustrations because of the painful pictures they conjure up. Wherever a Nazi army gained a new conquest, one of its first duties was to search out the Jews and organize their annihilation. They were herded into camps, burned and gassed, fought to dig their own graves, and then machine gunned into them. And then from 1941 onwards, the final solution, the concentration camps, Dachau, Auschwitz, Belsen, factories for the mass production of death, they have been described. Trainloads of Jews arrived daily from various parts of Europe to meet their end in the gas chambers. Of 3.3 million Jews in Poland, no less than 3 million perished, and in all, over 6 million Jews died. Well, so we come to the end of our brief summary of the history of the Jews in Western Europe. It's a general story of persecution and segregation, but not without its periods of apparent peace and security. How true are the words of God, whom they rejected? The Lord shall scatter thee among all people, from the one end of the earth even unto the other. And among these nations thou shalt find no ease, neither shall the sole of thy foot have rest, but the Lord shall give thee there a trembling heart, and failing of eyes, and sorrow of mind, and thy life shall hang in doubt before thee, and thou shalt fear day and night, and shall have none assurance of thy life. But it's not all black, as we know. Having been justly punished for their national sins, the future for them is bright. After yet one more time of Jacob's trouble will come the blessings of the kingdom. What a turning of the tables. Israel, the head of the nations, all peoples coming with gifts, imploring their blessing, desiring their company. We shall go with you because we know that God is with you. And so, as we sometimes sing, all Israel will be saved. May we, in God's mercy, be privileged to witness that final restoration.